and welcome to the latest Sounds Sport podcast. I'm your host, Matt Solomon, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Derek Wilcox. So Derek is the lightest person to have squatted above 1,000 pounds. He's a coach of Renaissance Periodization, and he's got his PhD in sport physiology and performance, which makes him the perfect person today to discuss how you can use evidence-based practice and practice-based evidence. So without further ado, it's time to welcome Derek onto the show. So Derek, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So can you give us a quick introduction as to who you are and what you've been up to until now?
Well, I've been up to a good bit. I've had a relatively long career already. I have a PhD in sport physiology and performance. I was a professional powerlifter for well over a decade. I've been training for about a quarter century now, so I've got a lot of experience there. Work with tons of different kinds of athletes, but I also work with tons of people in general population. I genuinely love it all. I'm really just a people person, and it doesn't matter if I'm helping somebody break world records or if it's just, you know, a grandparent that wants to be able to get up off the couch and play with their grandkids. It's all kind of the same to me. So that's what I've been doing for, I've been with Renaissance Periodization, specifically remote coaching, for well over a decade at this point. So it's been a really cool journey.
Absolutely excellent. So you've got that kind of combined the research side of things with the applied side of things, and obviously being a good lifter yourself, combining that with the online side of coaching. So we're going to discuss kind of practice-based evidence versus evidence-based practice. Can you give us a quick introduction as to what those terms might mean?
Oh, well, practice-based. Yeah, how did you put that? That was really
practice-based evidence, evidence-based practice.
Yeah, practice-based evidence. I usually break that down between the concepts of wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom is something that you go through with experience. You have to see it. It's kind of like it's the eye test. You see how things work over time, and it's a little bit of a black box approach where you see input and then you see output, but you don't see what's in the middle. You don't see the gears and all the mechanics working in the background. And then the evidence-based approach is very much the opposite of that. That's where you have a white box approach. You see your input, and then you actually see the physiology and the kinesiology and everything else that's actually going on behind the scenes with all the training and the nutrition that you're doing, and then you see the output. But those two worlds very often do not mix very well, whether it's because of personality problems or I think they're both so incredibly involved, it's very difficult to get a deep education in both.
And yeah, why do you think that they don't mix them? Because yeah, that's a super interesting little avenue to go down quickly. And I don't want to spend too much time on it because we're going to discuss other stuff. But why do you think that those two worlds collide as opposed to kind of amalgamate together?
Well, the career path really divulges hard, like probably around high school or so, because mostly with the evidence-based practice people, you've got tons of people who work in a science lab. Now, there aren't a ton of super high-level athletes that work in sport science labs or science labs in general, because to be a top-tier athlete, you have to dedicate basically your entire life to that. And on the other end of things, if you want to be an incredible researcher, it's just a giant time suck that you can't get away from the lab because you're always doing research and you're having to write, and especially you're having to do actual research, reading peer-reviewed articles and things like that. So both lines of, you know, those career paths are incredibly, incredibly draining and demanding. So when you have people who go down one path or the other, they kind of get stuck in their own little echo chambers to a certain degree, and the practicalities of each get missed, I think, on the other side.
So then when you're looking as a practitioner, right, how do you think about combining these two things? Because, yeah, obviously you've got evidence here and you've got evidence there. They're both evidence, but how do you then combine that in your mind to allow those two conflicting messages to come together?
Well, we call that bridging the gap in sports science. And most of the time it's very personality based. And you know, typically you have head coaches in a sport, they have to have an ego. And egos are not a bad thing. Poorly applied egos are definitely a bad thing, but that happens in the lab as well, because the sports scientist who's always in the lab and hasn't done much time in the sport working or especially participating, they're going to say, you guys obviously don't know what you're doing, because all the physiological principles behind the training that you're doing, you know, X, Y, and Z, you're clearly you know, not following these principles, and then you get these problems. It's really, really obvious. And then you go on the other side of the building, and all the sport coaches are like, yeah, we can't apply those things because it doesn't make any sense in the real world. So things on paper don't always match up to the practicalities of training athletes in the real world, because there's so many more variables that require experience and a little bit of finesse and a little bit of nuance to actually apply things. So you end up making trade-offs that don't look great on paper.
I'm excited to hear a little bit more about the practical side of the finesse in just a few minutes' time. But before we get onto that, what are then the advantages and disadvantages of these things? So let's take experience-based learning and experience-based practice first. What are the advantages and disadvantages to having a really strong basis in the experience side of things?
An experienced coach, one, their people skills have to be incredibly good. Traditionally, you're not going to see, you know, researchers who have overwhelming people skills, because they're in a lab. They don't work with that many people. They work with subjects. With coaches, their whole business is people. You can be the worst strategic coach in the world, but if you're a good motivator and you connect with people, your athletes on a deep, deep level, you can get them to run through walls. And even if the approach is not great, the fact that they are more motivated than another team will bring you success. And we've seen tons and tons of different examples of that on every level. So you also get a really cool instinctual feel. Coaches get gut feelings because they've been exposed to so much in their sport over years and years and years of experience. They can kind of look at things and think, you know, they just have an idea of what's wrong and what's right. And I think that's kind of one of those things that gets in the way of them working with sports scientists a lot, because sports scientists don't have that bit of context. And coaches, you know, they may not know exactly why they don't like something, but it's kind of like the smell test. Like something just seems off. And it creates conflict. But there's so many great benefits of that wisdom that those kinds of coaches can have.
And what's then the disadvantage to having that kind of practice-led approach? So obviously you have great people skills, and that's a super strong advantage, especially as a coach. But yeah, are there any gaps that are then missing?
For sure. Yeah, it's one thing that comes with having larger egos is you tend to be closed-minded. And that's the stereotype, right? Like, people don't want to change what they're doing, especially if they've been winning in the past or been a part of a winning program. They kind of have a formula in their head, and it's like, well, this is what we did to win the national championship in 1998. Then that's what works. That'll work for everything. You can apply it to all sports, and it's just going to work. And on the sports science side, we can actually look at the nuts and bolts of that and start to break down different variables and say, okay, well, maybe this doesn't apply quite the same way. We're working different energy systems. We have more efficient practices. There are actual evidence in peer-reviewed articles that contradicts what you're saying to do, and say maybe there's actually a higher risk of injury as well. So we have to be responsible towards the athletes. And when you just have that more experience-based approach, you really miss out on a lot of really useful information that's going to take your team to the next level a lot of times.
So then similarly for the evidence-based practice crowd, what are the advantages there as to having a really strong scientific rationale for everything you do?
Well, it goes back to that black box versus white box approach. With the white box approach, with sports scientists and people in more in research, they can look in and see the nuts and bolts of things and really see the gears turning in the background, or at least have a really, really good idea. Physiology is not perfect. We don't have the technology to measure everything to the, you know, the tiniest degree, so we know 100% of what's going on. Especially in sports science, our sample sizes are so small. In research in general, like training studies, we're lucky to get 15 to 20 people to participate. So the stats and the probabilities and things like that, not all that strong, especially compared to bigger sciences like geology or something. But with that approach, we can get a much more refined idea of what best practices are. But it's still up to the sport coaches to figure out how to apply those concepts. And that's where bridging the gap comes together really, really well. And it's so important.
And then the disadvantages for an evidence-based approach, because I think it sounds fantastic, right? Like, well, we believe in the science and the science tells us what to do, and that's really, really strong rationale. But yeah, what are then the disadvantages to being maybe take that a little bit further, being caught up in that kind of approach?
Totally. It's I think most people have painted at some point in their life. And I think sports scientists are kind of like the people who make the paint, but who very, very often don't do any painting. So you can develop in theory this incredible paint that can do all kinds of things and look absolutely amazing on a wall, but you go to a specific scenario out in the real world where a painter has to use this, and the paint doesn't match up to the surface that they're painting it to. You know, this is not a hypothetical thing. This is a very specific circumstance, and with things like that, you need somebody with some wisdom and experience to figure out how to apply the paint properly or to make adjustments. They might need to put some paint thinner in the paint, but the paint's supposed to be allegedly perfect on paper. So that's what sport coaches end up having to do. They, in ideal circumstances, they take the information that's great on paper from the sports scientists and they apply it the best they can to their situations. And so a lot of times sports scientists kind of get a little offended by that because, you're messing up this perfect idea that I had. Was like, well, the world's not perfect. So these things take a lot of oh crap, what's the word? I'm missing it. It's
Like
too early in the morning.
nuance, adjustment.
Compromise.
Yeah.
This is what I was looking for, but
Got
yes,
it. There
those
we go.
adjustments
There
through
we go.
compromise.
Perfect. So then when we try and bring this together, obviously we would like to have some kind of aspects of both of those, right? So you want a strong scientific base, but you want to be able to apply that to your specific situation. So when it comes to then bridging that gap, how can coaches or teams even then start to bridge that gap to really optimize the beneficial aspects of both of those approaches?
Well, first off, you have to be very open-minded and you have to leave your ego at the door. If your ego is associated with having people listen to you because you want to be presented as correct, then that's problem number one. That's almost insurmountable. If your ego is related to winning and success of the athletes that you're working with, then that's not going to be an issue because they are the priority. Winning is the priority. You are not the priority. So that's the biggest step because that happens on both sides a vast majority of the time, and it creates a barrier that's impassable. And I think obviously sport coaches, they know what they're doing in their sport, and having them keep an open mind and have that passion for winning to look for new avenues is incredibly special. And honestly, it takes a lot of character to be able to do that, a lot of humility. With sports scientists specifically, I think it is absolutely imperative that they train, that they actually go do the sport, they go have the experience. Because especially with athletes, you try to go in for some kind of monitoring testing with a bunch of athletes, and they look at you and they talk to you just a little bit, and they will figure you out within a minute if you are full of crap or not. And a lot of times sports scientists don't pass that test and the athletes do not invest emotionally and they don't put much effort into what the sports scientists want them to do. It throws off all the testing, screws up your numbers, and you figure out pretty quick, like, well, this is all pretty useless. It's a waste of time because they aren't bought in. So having that rapport as a sports scientist, go walk the walk. It is so incredibly important. It will give you the respect of the athletes. It gives you the respect of the coaches. All those things, and that's a huge, huge part of bridging that gap.
Absolutely excellent. So, when it comes to then bringing this together, can you give us an example of how you've gone about this in the past? So, yeah, obviously you've got the strong PhD background, but obviously there's the strong applied background too. So, can you just talk us through how, for example, you might have done that previously to really get that buy-in and combine both of those worlds? Maybe with some examples of trade-offs that you have to make along the way.
The first thing you have to do is turn on your ears. Because especially with sports scientists, they tend to come into situations a lot more often than a new coach comes into a situation. So you already have something established that you're going to be working within the parameters of. So developing a good rapport with the coach and making sure they understand that you're not there to dictate to them. You are there to help facilitate. and optimize what they are doing. You have to buy into their program first and foremost to get that trust. And once that is established, that's where the relationship starts. That's the core tenet of what you're doing. They understand what you're there for, and it's not going to be a big conflict. So it's never about trying to change the coach's practices. It's about presenting options for them to consider. And if you're a really good sports scientist, the head coach will think it was their idea to change those methods when you were proposing them to begin with. So it's one of those kinds of things. You don't want to disturb, but you want to enhance, but you don't want to take over.
And can you talk us through how you've done that in the past? So obviously that sounds like something I would love to do. Can you give us an example of how that might work?
Certainly. I think the easiest example was when I started working with D1 men's golf. The coach that had been there had tons and tons of success. Incredibly smart guy. He'd been running that team so well. And I had a lot of respect for him. But of course, with my powerlifting background, when I came to the program, this was 2014, we were top 25 in the nation program already. So there was a standard of excellence. The coach looks at me and says, I don't want that guy working with my team. And of course, the question was why. And he's like, I don't want my players looking like him. I was about 235, 5'6", and still competing in powerlifting. I was squatting over 1,000 pounds at the time. And he did not want the golfers to start looking like me. And I was like, Coach, it took me 6 months to be able to get to work with them because I had to go find him and communicate. It's like, Coach, there's no reason on the planet any golfer should ever look like me. I've played golf since I could stand up, but I can barely swing a club right now. And I think once I was able to communicate, it was like, I completely agree with you. I don't want them looking like me either, but I have the background in golf. I played in high school. I've played literally since I could stand up. My dad had a tiny set of clubs next to my crib so that when I was big enough to crawl out of it, I could grab them and go. So I've loved golf my entire life, but he didn't know that. So I had to communicate. I had to develop that relationship. And eventually, through my 5 years at ETSU, they were actually able to change the recruiting strategies where they started recruiting smaller people who had really, really good short games, but they didn't quite have the distance because they knew that our strength conditioning program was going to improve that over time. And we were able to really build some great athletes there.
I think that's an excellent example and really interesting to see how, you kind of got that stereotype on the front end, like, you're massive. We don't want to be massive. We want to have some kind of like refined skill, whatever. It's really difficult to kind of overcome those barriers when you walk into a room and you're like, well, yeah, can't really hide the fact I'm massive. So, what are we supposed to do with this? It's difficult to kind of, to overcome that stereotype initially. But it's an excellent example of how it can be done as well, right? So when it comes to then the evidence side of it, how did you then get your message across? Because you didn't just say, look, this is my practice, this is how I'm gonna train them how I train. Like, I'm gonna use the evidence that I know from other principles or other research that I might have read to apply it differently to them. How did you kind of bridge that gap?
Well, I was really, really lucky there because I had an incredibly great mentor in Dr. Kimi Sato, who was already working with the golf team at that point. And I was brought in not really because I looked like a great golfer, obviously, but I've been competing in powerlifting at the top international level, breaking world records and things like that. I was brought in because I knew how to win. I understood the mindset and the athletes respond to that. It's kind of like that smell test that I was talking about earlier. The athletes knew that I knew what I was talking about, even if it wasn't quite in their avenue. And I respected them, and I went and played golf with those guys a lot. And it really helped with that relationship as well, just getting in there, walking the walk, like I said. But the evidence-based practice with golf was actually way better than I thought it was going to be because we had so much research that had been done that I got to learn about that showed how much strength really does matter in golf, not just for distance and maximum effort shots, but golfers usually swing 80 to 90% effort so they can keep everything refined and online. If you can take your capacity for your distance, if you can hit a driver 320 yards, You take that 90% swing, you know, it's going to be a little under 300, but it's going to be consistent. If we can move that 100% distance up to 350, then that same effort swing is going to be about 320 or so, or 315. So those are the kinds of improvements that we really saw. And stronger golfers are actually better putters as well, according to the research. So going through all those things, we're able to tell the players about the research, and they're like, oh, wow, that's really cool. You would have never thought that. Then the coaches buy in more because they see happy players. So it's all about taking those little things, applying them appropriately, and then sneaking in the reasoning to where, you know, everybody buys in and they're happy with the approach.
I love the idea of just sneaking in little pieces of information there. That's absolutely excellent. So, Derek, massive thanks for your time and effort on today's podcast. It's a pleasure for talking to you. Where can people find a little bit more information about you and what you're up to?
Well, you can go to Instagram at Wilcox Strength Inc. WilcoxStrengthInc.com as well has a lot of my information on it for coaching and my background. You can find me on Facebook under the same name as well.
Absolutely excellent. So, Derek, massive thanks. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking again soon.
Pleasure, man. Thank you.
And that's it once again. A massive thanks to Derek for all of his hard work on today's podcast. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you did at home too. Before you leave, I want to point you in the direction of the Science of Sport Coach Academy. The Coach Academy is an overgrowing library of sports science courses broken down into bite-sized chunks. So if you've enjoyed today's podcast and you want to get your hands on some more great sports science information, all you have to do is hit the link in the show notes so you can get into the Coach Academy completely for free for the next 7 days. What's more, every time you complete one of the courses, you'll get a certificate of completion to prove your ongoing education. And if you have enjoyed today's podcast, it'd be fantastic if you could recommend us to a coach, a colleague, an athlete, or a friend. That means that we can keep bringing you the best possible guests and the best possible content. And that's it. Once again, a massive thanks from me and Matt Solomon for Science of Sport. And I'll speak to you next week.